Okay, so last time we finished the book of Deuteronomy, so we're starting on the book of Joshua, and hopefully we'll get through Judges and Ruth as well. Now, Joshua and Judges belong to the section of the Old Testament that the Christians call the historical books. Now, and they would include Ruth in that. Now, the Jews would call Joshua and Judges as being part of the former prophets, as they call them. The latter prophets being what we call prophets, the former prophets being what we call historical books generally. But Ruth is actually included among the writings in the Jewish canon because it's a little later in origin, although it had to have come from around the time of King David. But we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get to that. Now, the book of Joshua is sometimes included along with the Pentateuch or the books of Moses as being one group. You sometimes will hear the phrase hexateuch, which just is pente means five in Greek, hex is six. Sometimes you even hear the phrase octateuch, which includes Judges and Ruth as being all part of it because it's something that sort of groups everything prior to the monarchy coming on the scene. For example, Blessed Theodoret, who's a commentator that from the 5th century that I like to read, he's a lot like St. John Chrysostom in many respects, and he has a commentary, or actually it's questions and answers on the Octateuch, and he just goes through these eight books and asks questions or puts questions that people have put to him about these books and answers them, so it's not a commentary per se, like a typical commentary, but it does cover a lot of interesting material. But traditionally, we do separate the books of Moses into one category. But what you should understand, though, is that it's not like there's a radical shift from Deuteronomy to Joshua. There's really a flow that goes from one to the next. Now, one thing about the book of Joshua, the name Joshua is the same as the name for Jesus in Hebrew. So the fathers very often pointed out that Joshua was a type of Christ. If you think about it, Moses got the Israelites to the border of the Promised Land, but he couldn't get them into the Promised Land. Joshua had to take them there. So you can kind of think of it as a law being a tutor that brings you to Christ, but it takes Christ for you to actually be saved. In John chapter 1, verse 17, it says, "For the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ." Well, if you were reading this in Greek, every time you saw Joshua in the Bible, it would say Jesus. And so you would be thinking, well, that's the same name as Christ. And it's not coincidental. It's providential. Joshua literally means Yahweh saves. And so that's what Christ did, was he saved us. And so the commentaries of the fathers are generally going to make a lot of references like that to Christ and show how Joshua was a type of him. Now,
so why did we in English, why did it come out as two different names? I mean, it seems odd.
Well, you can thank William Tyndale and the King James Version because since they were translating it from the Hebrew, what the original King James did was, is whenever they were translating from the Hebrew, they would use a transliteration of a Hebrew name. But in the New Testament, they would use Greek names. So like when Isaiah is referred to in the original King James in the New Testament, he's Isaias. Or Jeremiah is Jeremy. Or Hosea is Hoseas. Or Osias or something like that. I can't remember. But most editions of the King James, since in more recent times, they try to have some consistency, so they change those to the names that they're more commonly known as. And this is a problem because I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that there's a place in the book of Hebrews where there's some parallel made between Joshua and Christ, and you can kind of miss the connection if you don't have that translation. I mean, if you don't understand that this connection in their names. I've mentioned this before, but your name, James, is another example of one of these things where, because of the way it's been, the history of English translation, you wouldn't know that James was Jacob. But that's what it is, so you just have to know that. I mean, you could make a case for maybe if we had an Orthodox translation, we ought to just go ahead and make Joshua Jesus in the Old Testament. But the problem is then no one would know who you were talking about when you're talking about Jesus, the son of Nun, in the Old Testament. So it's just a problem we have in English, but most languages don't have this issue. Now, as far as who wrote the book of Joshua, it's traditionally ascribed to Joshua. However, like the book of Deuteronomy, it records the death of Joshua, so it probably wasn't actually written by Joshua, at least in its final form, although he probably did write at least portions of it. Particularly at the very beginning of the book of Joshua, there are sections of it that have the feel of being an eyewitness account of what's happened. So, quite likely, that could have been written by Joshua himself. But there are references in the book of Joshua to sources, like it talks about the book of Jasher as being a source in one place. Now, some scholars try to find the JEDP sources that we talked about in the Pentateuch, also in Joshua. But again, I think it's bogus in the books of Moses, and it's even more bogus in the book of Joshua to go looking for these sources. The structure of the book is you have. Let me see. You've got four main sections. You've got the commissioning of Joshua, which is the first part of the first chapter. And then you've got the entry in the land, which is the rest of the first chapter through chapter 5. And then you've got the conquest of the land, which goes from chapter 6 to 12. Then after that, there's the division of the land, chapters 13 through 22. And then at the very end, you've got the conclusion. So I guess there are five sections. But to go into a little bit more detail, you've got the commissioning, then the entry in the land, and this is divided into the preparations, which are the rest of chapter 1. Then they send the spies into Jericho, and there is the whole story about how they go into Jericho and they're saved by Rahab the harlot. And they agree to save Rahab and her family, but the sign is that she has to have a red cord hanging out her window, and anyone who's not in the house is going to be killed and her family. So that's the promise that they make, is we're not making any guarantees for anybody outside of this house, but anyone in this house will make sure that they're spared. And the fathers see this as an image of the church, is that this is the place of refuge. And some fathers even talk about the scarlet thread that goes through the entire Old Testament, and they use that as an image of that, as throughout the Old Testament you have these kinds of things that allude to Christ. And of course, she's an ancestor of Christ as well. Then you've got chapter 3, the crossing of the Jordan. Chapter 4, they set up the memorial stones, because what they do when the River Jordan stops, they go and they take 12 stones out of the middle of the river and they set up a monument of 12 stones for the people to remember what God did there. And then they camp at Gilgal. And then chapter 5, they have the first circumcision of the people since they left Egypt, because apparently when they're on the road, it wasn't very conducive to that purpose. So they did that, and they gave people time to recover before they went further. And then at the end of that, the second half of that chapter is when Joshua has this encounter with the Lord of hosts, which the fathers see as being Christ pre-incarnate appearing to Joshua. He has this scene where he says, "Are you with us or with our enemies?" And the angel says, "Neither. I'm the commander of the Lord of hosts." And he is told that he's going to be successful in what he needs to do with Jericho. Then the next section is the conquest of the land. Chapter 6 is the conquest of Jericho. And most of you are familiar with that story. But connected with that story is that they were told by God that people were not to take any loot from the city of Jericho, that everything was to be destroyed, even the last animal was to be destroyed. Nothing was to be taken from the city of Jericho. And this in Hebrew it's called haram, I believe is the way that it's put, but it's related to the word that you've heard, harem. What is a harem? A harem is the place where some Muslim guy has got all of his wives. Well, the reason why they use that word is that it means it's off limits to anyone other than him. And so when something was declared haram in the Bible, that means that this is off limits to anyone because this belongs to the Lord. This place is under judgment. And a lot of times people have a hard time with this because in the New Testament, we're told to turn the other cheek. We're told, you know, that God's a God of mercy and of all that. But you have to understand what the fathers point out about this, and I'll talk a little bit more about this later, is that you're dealing with very spiritually immature people among the Israelites, for one. And number two, the Canaanites were an extremely evil people. And they didn't have the kind of technology that we have today, because today, if we were in this situation, for number one, we wouldn't be susceptible to a bunch of idolaters influencing us the same way that those people were, because they didn't have anything like the level of maturity that later generations of even Jews before the New Testament had. And so they were very susceptible to being influenced by idolaters. But these people practiced ritual prostitution and child sacrifice, and you have to imagine that if that's how they treated their own children, there probably wasn't a whole lot redeemable in that culture. And so anyway, there was one person among the Jews, or the Israelites, I should say, who didn't obey that commandment. His name was Achan. He took some of the loot and he hid it. And so in chapter 7, the Israelites go to the next city, the city of Ai, to take it, but they are defeated. And they're wondering, you know, God, what's wrong? And God reveals to them that there was one person that didn't do what they were supposed to do. And then God reveals who it was. And so Achan is stoned. That sin is removed from the people. But the thing there goes to show how even small sins that people commit in the church can have a negative effect on the entire church. Then after that, they go back and they actually take the city of Ai and they burn it to the ground. Now, as far as how God treated the different cities that they took, every city was not destroyed completely like the city of Jericho was. In each case, God gave them specific instructions on how to deal with them. Then in chapter 9, Joshua makes a treaty with the Gibeonites, and the Gibeonites actually were like right on the path of the conquest, but Joshua didn't know who they were, so they dressed up in ragged clothes and they had stale bread with them, and they acted like they'd come from a long way, and they said, hey, we want to make a treaty with you. And Joshua says, great, we'll make a treaty with you because we're not worried about people who are not anywhere as near us. And so he makes this treaty and then discovers these people live nearby. So because he made this promise, he didn't destroy them, but he did make them servants to the Israelites. So the Gibeonites as a people were spared. Then chapter 10, Joshua goes to the south part of Israel and he conquers it. So it's one thing after the next, and he's successful in almost every term. And then chapter 11, you have the campaign to the north. Then chapter 12, there's sort of a summary of Joshua's conquest. And then in chapters 13 through 22, there's the division of the land. Chapter 13 talks about what was left to be done, and it talks about the tribes that lived on the other side of the Jordan River. Then chapter 14 talks about the portion for Caleb, who was the one other spy who at the time of the first attempt to go into the Holy Land gave a good report, along with Joshua. And then chapter 15 talks about the portion for Judah. Chapter 16 through 17 talks about the portion for Joseph, which would be the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, which Ephraim was the biggest tribe out of the northern kingdom, so that's sometimes used to refer to the entire 10 tribes of the northern kingdom. But then they talk about the remaining tribes at chapters 18 through 19. And then the cities of refuge, which were cities that if you killed somebody accidentally, you could go to, and as long as you stayed in that city, then the relatives couldn't get revenge on you. But then at the high priest, and when the high priest died, after that you could leave the city of refuge, and you still couldn't get the family members could not exact vengeance on you. So that was the one time that they got to have to leave that. And then the cities of the Levites, because the Levites, because they were priests and servers of the temple, didn't have their own territory per se, but they did have cities throughout the land where they were able to live and have farms and stuff like that. But then in their rotations, they would serve in the tabernacle and then later in the temple. And then in chapter 21, towards the end of it, through chapter 40, at the very end of it, it talks about the promise being fulfilled. And that's kind of the main theme of the book of Joshua, is that all the things that God promised in the book of Deuteronomy about if you do what I tell you to do and you obey and you serve the Lord, you'll be blessed, you see mostly fulfilled, with the exception of the incident with Achan in the book of Joshua. In the last part of that chapter, it says, "And the Lord gave unto Israel all the land which he sware to give unto their fathers, and they possessed it and dwelt therein. And the Lord gave them rest round about according to all that he sware unto their fathers. And there stood not a man of all their enemies before them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand. There failed not out of aught of any good thing which the Lord had spoken unto the house of Israel. All came to pass." And then chapter 22 talks about the departure of the Transjordan tribes. In other words, these are the people who they already had their inheritance. Now they're going back to their inheritance because the main battles of the time of Joshua, at least, are finished. And then you have Joshua's farewell address in chapter 23. And then you have the covenant at Shechem and another speech in chapter 24 with the death of Joshua. And of course, you have the famous statement of Joshua where he says, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." You know, and basically telling the people, you have to make a choose this day whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord. Now, getting back to the question of the violence of the Old Testament, and one thing that also comes clear when you get into the book of Judges, and that's that there still was a lot left to be done as far as the conquest, even though there came a point where they sort of were satisfied with what they had taken so far, and there was a time of rest for the people. And the commandment that the God gave them, that they were to drive out the Canaanites entirely, they never fulfilled. And this was a constant thorn in the side of the people of Israel all the way up until the time of the exile. In Psalm chapter 105, or chapter 106 in the King James, verses 34 through 39, it says, "They did not destroy the heathen concerning which the Lord had spoken to them. They mingled among the nations and learned their works. They served their graven things, and it became for them a stumbling block. And they sacrificed their sons and their daughters unto demons. They poured out innocent blood, the blood of their sons and daughters, whom they sacrificed to the graven things of Canaan. And the land was befouled with the blood of murder, and it was defiled with their works, and they went a-whoring with their own inventions." So this was ultimately the reason why God destroyed the kingdoms of Israel and Judah later. First Israel, Judah was spared for about another 100 years, and then eventually they were destroyed as well because they engaged in child sacrifice, the shedding of innocent blood. And it says in 2 Kings, I believe, at a certain point, it's even after Josiah, who was one of the good kings who tried to turn things around in Israel, in Judah, after he died, his sons were sort of like the final twittering or the twilight of the kingdom of Judah. And it says that because of all the innocent blood that was shed during the reign of Manasseh, who was, I think, one or two generations before Josiah, God would not forgive. So that innocent blood they had to answer for, which is something that we as Americans should keep in mind, because we shed a million innocent children every year, the blood of an innocent million children. And so there is a day of account for every nation in history for that sort of thing. Blessed Theodoret says this about the violence that you find. The question is, "There are those who accuse the prophet Joshua of cruelty for slaying everyone without exception and crucifying the kings," because there's one part in there where they hang the kings of these five kings on trees. And so his answer is this: Whoever accuses the prophet accuses him who gave the order. It was he who, through Moses, the lawgiver, enjoined the slaying of every single inhabitant of that land for reaching the limit of lawlessness and committing crimes deserving of extermination. For this reason, in ancient times, he brought on the floods and wiped out Sodom and Gomorrah with fire. The prophet also ordered the officers to place their feet on the necks of the kings so that they would grow in confidence and go in battle with greater enthusiasm. And this is just what Jesus our Lord told us to do. Lo, I have given you power to walk on snakes, scorpions, and all the might of the foe. So may we too put our feet on the necks of hostile spirits. So the point there, if you think about it like this, I usually don't hear people who have an objection, for example, the fact that God flooded the earth in the times of Noah. But when God flooded the earth, what happened? Everybody but Noah's family was wiped out. Animals were wiped out. And we tend not to think of that as being a huge problem because we know God is God and he can judge as he pleases. He's the giver of life and he can take it. Whereas in the case of the book of Joshua, when we have the Israelites going around and slaying everybody in Jericho, we tend to think, well, wait a minute, you know, they're not God. But the thing is if they were commanded by God to do it, it was God using them as an instrument to wreak his judgment. Now, the problem we have again with that also is well, we don't want some religious fanatic to come up and say, well, God told me to wipe out everybody in Houston, and because we don't really believe God told him that. But if you were an Israelite at the time of Joshua, you would have seen God work one miracle after the next. So you really wouldn't have had any doubt that God was speaking through Joshua and through Moses. So when they told you what to do, you would know that it was really coming from God. And again, the Israelites didn't actually fulfill what they were told to do. So that even though they actually should have wiped out every Canaanite that was there or ran them out of the land, they actually didn't do that. And that was their snare. And then later on, you find the prophets pronouncing judgment on the Israelites, and he used the pagan neighbors to punish them. And so the Israelites wound up being on the receiving end of God's judgment, just like the Canaanites were on the receiving end of God's judgment in the book of Joshua. So any questions on that before we move on to Judges?
Just a real quick question. Earlier when you mentioned Joshua's covenant with the Gibeonites, was he in some way obligated to keep the covenant even though it was done under false pretenses? Or he just honored it because he was an honorable man?
Well, the Israelites were firm believers that when you made a covenant, you had an obligation to keep it, although they didn't always keep it with God. But, I mean, in their culture, they had a strong sense that once you gave your word, it was irrevocable. Well, think about when Isaac blessed Jacob rather than Esau. That was by deceit, but once he had given the blessing, he didn't consider it to be something that was revocable. So yeah, he did feel obligated to keep it.
Is there some modern day correlation we could make to that in our everyday living?
Well, I would say that as Christians, we should be people of our word. Now, the fathers tell us that we shouldn't, and Christ himself said we shouldn't swear oaths, certainly not lightly. But oath breaking is something that is considered to be a very serious sin. So like when you do make an oath, which again should be done very rarely, it's something that you're absolutely bound to as a Christian. Unless, I mean, if you made an oath that was foolish, like what's his name, Herod, when he said, you know, I'll give you, you know, up to a half of my kingdom, whatever you ask, he should have broke his oath rather than to fulfill that one, because it was a greater sin to fulfill the oath than it was to break it. But yeah, it's not something that you should break lightly. Okay, the book of Judges. The book of Judges is kind of the flip side of the book of Joshua. In Joshua, the people are blessed, they're victorious because they're generally speaking doing what they're supposed to do. In the book of Judges, they're continually not doing what they're supposed to do and falling into sin and then being punished by God, but then God would keep raising up judges who would deliver them. Another thing that this shows is after the time of Joshua, the level of organization of the tribes was dramatically reduced. When Joshua was around, everybody answered to Joshua, and he could tell one tribe to do this or that, and they would listen to him. But after the time of Joshua, they essentially began operating relatively independently, although sometimes one tribe would turn to help for a tribe that was nearby, but it wasn't like you had all 12 tribes uniting together to fight a common foe like you had at the time of Joshua. At the very beginning of Joshua, chapter 1, the first four verses, it says this: "Now after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, 'Who shall go up for us against the Canaanites first to fight against them?' And the Lord said, 'Judah shall go up. Behold, I have delivered the land into his hand.' And Judah said to Simeon, his brother, a neighboring tribe." So it's talking about a tribe as if it's a person, but it's actually the entire tribe. "Judah said to Simeon, his brother, 'Come up with me into my lot, that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I likewise will go with thee into thy lot.' So Simeon went with him, and Judah went up, and the Lord delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand, and they slew of them in Bezek 10,000 men." Now, one thing I forgot to mention, and that's that when it's talking about judges, this is a little bit confusing to us, because when we think of a judge, we're thinking of a guy in a black robe who's hearing cases. But these judges, although Deborah actually did hear cases, and maybe some of these other judges did as well, but we don't hear that being talked about, but they primarily were military leaders, but they were people who were inspired by God to lead the people. So God would raise them up, and it's not like they were inherited. It wasn't like a monarchy where you had the son of this person would then become the next judge. God would just raise someone up who had no connection with a previous judge, and that person would begin to lead the people. There's a little bit of analogy in the Texas. For you know, if you think about the county judge, Ed Emmett doesn't hear cases. He's more like the equivalent of a mayor of the county. He's in charge of county government. He doesn't sit and hear cases, and so that's kind of a little bit more like what the judges in Israel were. So the book of Judges, the very beginning, it has a summary of the conquest. Chapter 2, it talks about Israel's disobedience, and then in chapter 2, beginning with verse 11 through 19, it lays out what the pattern of the book is. So if you understand this, it's basically saying this is the pattern that you're going to see repeated over and over again throughout this book. "And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Balaam," which is the plural of Baal. So they served the Baals. "And they forsook the Lord God of their fathers, which brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods of the gods of the people that were round about them, and bowed themselves unto them, and provoked the Lord to anger. And they forsook the Lord and served Baal and Ashtaroth," Ashtaroth being the fertility goddess. So Baal being the main god of the Canaanites, male god, and Ashtaroth, the female goddess of fertility. "And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he delivered them into the hands of spoilers that spoiled them. And he sold them into the hands of their enemies round about, so that they could not any longer stand before their enemies. Whithersoever they went, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil, as the Lord had said, and as the Lord had sworn unto them, and they were greatly distressed." Now, when it says, "as the Lord had said," that's referring back to the book of Deuteronomy, where it gives all the curses. Your crops are going to not grow, your cattle are not going to bring forth the calves, and your children will die. I mean, it's just a whole list of all these horrible things that are going to happen to you if you don't obey the Lord. And basically, this is the pattern that we see repeated throughout this book. It said, "Nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges, which delivered them out of the hands of those that spoiled them. And yet they would not hearken unto their judges, but they went a-whoring after other gods, and bowed themselves unto them. They turned quickly out of the way which their fathers walked in, obeying the commandments of the Lord, but they did not so. And when the Lord raised them up judges, then the Lord was with the judge, and deliver them out of the hands of their enemies all the days of the judge. For it repented the Lord because of their groanings, by reason of them that oppressed them and vexed them. And it came to pass, when the judge was dead, that they returned and corrupted themselves more than their fathers, in following other gods to serve them, and to bow down unto them. They ceased not from their own doing, nor from their stubborn way. And so, not only did they keep going in the same pattern, but what you see throughout the book of Judges is that they keep getting worse. The depths that they sank to continually go downhill, and the very end of it's one of the most shocking scenes in the Bible. And a lot of times people will quote that as if, isn't the Bible a horrible book because it contains this? But it contains this story for a reason, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But the next section, it talks about the judges from the death of Joshua up to the death of Gideon. So you've got in chapter 3, Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, and then chapter 4, you've got Deborah, who's the only female judge. And the interesting thing about that story is that she's in the just a little bit to the south of the Galilee area. And if you ever go to the Holy Land, Mount Tabor is where Christ was transfigured, but it's also where this scene happens in the Old Testament, where the Israelites that she inspires to go fight the Canaanites. And one thing you have to keep in mind is the Israelites didn't have things at that time like chariots. They also didn't have iron weapons of their, at least they didn't have the ability to make iron weapons. So they were at a distinct technological disadvantage. But in this one battle, the Israelites go charging down the sides of Mount Tabor. And when you see the mountain, you can just imagine the people doing this. And there's these chariots of the enemy that are like in the valley below, but they flanked them, hit them on the side, and there wasn't anything they could do about it, and they defeated them. But Barak was the man who was the leader, and he was too much of a wimp. Deborah told him, look, I want you to go do this, or the Lord wants you to do this, and he says, I'm not going to do it unless you go with me. And so Deborah reluctantly does it, but she says, just know that a woman's going to share the glory of this victory. And then chapter 5 is the song of Deborah. And then chapter 6 through 8, it talks about Gideon, which Gideon's a very pivotal figure in the Old Testament. A lot of us are familiar with the stories of Gideon. There's the story about, he's hiding some food or something like that. And an angel appears to him, because he's hiding it from the Midianites. And the angel appears to him and he says, Hail, mighty warrior. And you have to wonder, there almost certainly is a little bit of sarcasm there. That, you know, look at you, you know, you're hiding food, you're afraid of the Midianites. But he starts telling him, look, God's chosen you to deliver his people. And so to test God, to see if God really was behind this, he asked God to make the fleece wet with dew, but the threshing floor that it was on in the morning dry. And that the next morning he wrings out the fleece and there's like a whole bowl full of water, but the threshing floor is dry. But to make sure that wasn't just a fluke, he says, okay, well, tonight I want you to make it just the reverse. Make the fleece dry, but the threshing floor wet. And the next day it was so. So he knew that God was behind it. And also, you're probably familiar with the story about how he had this big army of people who were ready to go fight with him. And God kept saying, whittle it down. You know, so he would, for example, he took them to a river. And everyone who stuck their faces down like a dog into the water, he said, tell those people to go home. But everyone who was drinking carefully and keeping their eye out for the enemy, he said, go ahead and take them. And he finally got down to 300 men, and they put torches under pots of some sort. And then at a certain point, they went into the camp, busted open those pots, made a noise, scared the whatever out of the Midianites, and defeated them. And so the point of that story is that God didn't need all those people to do what he needed to do, that God... if God was behind you, it didn't matter how many people that you had. Then after the time of Gideon, there's one of his sons. He had 70 sons, but one of his sons, Abimelech, decided he wanted to be... He must have had more than one wife, I'm guessing. one of his sons made a deal with the people of a particular village, and he said, do you want to have 70 people ruling over you or just one? And they agreed to cut this deal to where they would get some kind of favors from him. And he killed all of his brothers except for one. And this one got away, and he basically prophesied against him that this guy was not going to come to a good end, and it happened exactly as he said. So his reign, he was actually crowned as king, so he really was the first king, although it was very brief. And then he died. And then he was actually killed. Then chapters 10 through 12, it talks about the judges from the time of after Abimelech through Samson. And a lot of these people are talked about very briefly. There's Tola, there's Jer, and again, it talks about how the people fell away. And then there's Jephthah, who was successful and victorious, but he made a foolish vow, which is talked about in chapter 11, where he said, if God gives me victory, then I'll sacrifice to the Lord the first thing that comes out of the door of my home. And the first thing that came out of the door of his home was his daughter. And again, this was a foolish vow that he shouldn't have kept. Now, this is something I've mentioned before, but one of the things you have to keep in mind when you're reading these stories is that these stories are not there as a go forth and do likewise story. It's not saying that what Jephthah did was good or that fulfilling the vow was good, but his daughter actually said, look, you made the vow, so go ahead and keep it. And it doesn't actually describe her being sacrificed, although that's the implication. Although there are some people that think that she actually just dedicated herself to the Lord, which I suppose is possible. But it seems like if that was the ending, it would have been a lot happier and they would have mentioned it. So it probably wasn't that. And then there's an account of Jephthah having a conflict with the people of the tribe of Ephraim. And there's an interesting story there in chapter 12. It says that when they had this conflict, some of the tribe of Ephraim went over the River Jordan, and when they were trying to pass over, they would try to figure out who they were by a code word, you might say, or a shibboleth. It says, and when any Ephraimite who escaped said, let me cross over, and the word cross over the river, and the word shibboleth means flowing stream, the men of Gilead would say to him, are you an Ephraimite? If he said no, then he would say to him, then say shibboleth. And he would say sibboleth, because the people of Ephraim apparently didn't pronounce the sh sound. They would say s. So because they pronounced this word as sibboleth rather than shibboleth, they knew that they were an Ephraimite, and then they would kill him. And there fell at that time 42,000 Ephraimites. And so that's where that saying comes from, you know, where you talk about a shibboleth. That's just some sort of a magic word that some group uses to sort of show who they are. And then there's three more judges that they talk about towards the end of that chapter, Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon. And then the next section is about Samson. There's chapter 13 through 16. So quite a bit of the book of Judges focuses on Samson. And this is one of the more popular sections of this book because there's lots of interesting stories of Samson going around and doing heroic deeds. He was, you know, he was a Nazarite from birth. His birth was a miraculous birth, and his parents were told never to cut his hair, and because that was part of the Nazarite vow. But a Nazarite was supposed to be dedicated to the Lord, and yet when you read about Samson, you don't get the impression at any point in his life that he was a very pious man. He believed in God. But you find him going to Gaza and sleeping with some prostitute there. And, of course, he has this relationship with Delilah, who's not his wife. Earlier on, he falls in love with a Philistine girl. His parents object, but finally he insists on marrying her. And then I can't remember exactly what happened, but for some reason he didn't immediately take his wife because I remember what it is now. There was some sort of a dispute about a bet that they had at the wedding, and he got mad at his in-laws, and so his in-laws decided that maybe he didn't really want that wife and married her off to another man. And so then he, you know, basically did Rambo kind of stuff against the Philistines to get revenge, lit foxtail, or tied torches to foxes' tails and set them loose through the Philistines' fields and burned them down. And what it says is that God used all these things to punish the Philistines. So God used even Samson's foolishness and his sin, but that doesn't mean that Samson's behavior was what it should have been. It obviously wasn't. And of course, there's the story with Delilah, where Delilah is trying to find out what the secret to his strength is. Finally, he is cajoled into telling her the secret, and she cuts his hair, and then he's captured. And they poke his eyes out, and they keep him as a slave. And anytime they had some sort of a party or festival, they would take him out to mock him and have fun with him. But they didn't pay attention to the fact that his hair was growing back. And then his story ends with him praying that God would give him one last burst of strength. And he's in the temple, and he overthrows the main pillars of the temple of Dagon and kills himself along with all the Philistines that were in that temple. So these are all interesting stories. He was of the tribe of Dan, by the way. But this is showing yet further moral decay that the Israelites were going through. And then...
So, did Samson go to heaven if he killed himself?
Well, the thing is, whether he went to heaven or not, you know, I would say it's probably not something we could say for sure, although in the book of Hebrews chapter 11, it talks about him as being someone who did great things through faith. And so presumably all that time that his eyes were poked out and he was being mocked by the people, he had time to repent. So one can hope that he was saved. And also, he didn't have any hope of escaping, and this was his way of advancing the football down the field as far as defeating the Philistines. The Philistines were a particularly advanced people. They were seafaring people. They were very warlike, and they had very advanced weapons, and so they were very formidable foes for the Israelites. But after the time of Samson, there's an incident where there's someone who has an idol in chapter 17 by the name of Micah and leads the whole tribe of Dan into idolatry. They're constantly fighting the Philistines but not doing very well because they're being disobedient. So finally they give up trying to take the land around where the Philistines were, and they move to the very far edge of the Holy Land, which would be even north of Galilee, because they want to get that far away from the Philistines. And so that's how the name of a city there took on the name Dan. That's also why the River Jordan is called Jordan. Jordan means the River of Dan. And that's because they lived up near the source of the River Jordan, and it flowed downstream. Then in chapter 19, you have the story that I alluded to earlier, where you have a Levite who had a concubine, and he had some sort of a falling out with her. So she went home to her family, and that he went to go find her to talk her into coming back with him. And his father-in-law said, "Stay with me, you know, for a day or so. I miss my daughter. Let's have a feast." And then every day he would try to leave. His father-in-law kept saying, "We'll stay one more day." And finally, on the last day, he kept dragging things out. And this guy said, "Look, I'm going. Yeah, it's time for me to go." He said, "Look, the day is far spent. Stay one more night." And he figures, you know, he's just trying to keep me here indefinitely. So he goes and leaves, but it's already towards the evening, so it's not a good, safe time to be out on the road. And he avoids going to Jebus, which is the city of Jerusalem, but still at that time controlled by the Canaanites. They could have stopped there. That was closer, but he decided, "Well, I don't want to go there because those people are pagans." So he goes on to the city of Gibeah, which was in the area controlled by the tribe of Benjamin. And if you read that chapter, what happened is almost identical to what happened in Sodom, where you had the people of the town saying, "Bring out, you know, this visitor that you've got so that we can know him." So they wanted to rape the Levite. But the owner of the house that he was staying in said, "No, this is a shame." And it's hard for us to understand this, but you have to understand Middle Eastern concepts of hospitality. It would have been a bigger shame for this man, for his guest to be treated in this way, than it would be for his own daughter. So he offered his daughter to the mob. But for some reason, I can't remember, you have to read the passage, they wind up pushing out the concubine to the crowd, and then closing the door, and the people of this town abuse her throughout the night. And then the next day, this Levite very callously walks out the house and he says, "Let's go." And she's lying dead with her hands on the threshold, when you put your hands on the threshold, this is a sign of asking for sanctuary. Which, if you go back, actually this is later on in the book of Samuel, but in the book of Samuel, there's the time when the Ark of the Covenant was captured by the Philistines, and they put the Ark into the Temple of Dagon, and then one day the idol of Dagon is knocked over, and they put it back up, and then the next day they come back, and the idol of Dagon is not only knocked over, but its arms are broken off, and its hands are on the threshold of the temple. So it's like the god Dagon was saying, "Help me." but in this case, this concubine is about as pitiful of a scene as you can imagine. And so he finally just realizes that she's dead, and he's outraged, but again, not in the most caring way that one might treat the body of a deceased wife. He cuts her into 12 pieces. And he sends a piece to each of the tribes along with a message of what happened in this town. And so all the people of Israel are outraged that this happened, that the people had sunk to such a level. And it says, "And so it was that all who saw it said," all saw these 12 pieces, "no such deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, confer, and speak up." So all the other tribes except for Benjamin go to war against the tribe of Benjamin, because the tribe of Benjamin is saying, "We're not defending what happened, but we're not giving up our own people." And so they go to war, and it's a very bloody war, but the Benjamites are defeated. And the people of the rest of the tribes actually swore an oath that they wouldn't give any of their daughters to the people of Benjamin. But by the time this was over with, they didn't have any, very many women left to marry. And so in chapter 21, it talks about how they regretted that they had made this oath, but they basically allowed the men of Benjamin to kidnap some of their daughters and take them as wives. And so that's the happy ending of the book of Judges. And it ends with these words. It says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes." And so when you read all these horrible things that happened in the book of Judges, you should not read that and say that this somehow held up as a model of how people were supposed to have behaved in these situations. It's quite the opposite. And that last story, you could say, was actually even worse than what happened in Sodom and Gomorrah, because we don't know whether the people of Sodom would have actually have killed the two angels if they had been normal men and had had the opportunity to do what they wanted to do. But in this case, they actually murdered this woman as well as brutally raped her. And then this Levite, who you would think maybe had some religious piety, cuts her into 12 pieces, to send word to the tribes of how this whole thing had happened. So it's an unhappy book that shows what happens when people don't obey God, and all the depths of sin that the Israelites kept continually descending into. So any questions on that before we talk about the book of Ruth? And that won't take very long. Y'all are just stunned into silence. Okay, the book of Ruth is set during the time of Judges. And if you think about the historical narrative, Judges really flows into 1 Samuel, which we'll talk about next time. The book of Ruth was something that was composed probably during the time of King David. Now, the book of Judges itself was put, at least in its final form, at some time during the monarchy, because you find a couple places where it says that in those days there was no king. Well, you wouldn't say in those days there was no king unless you were living in a time when there was a king. And that final statement about in those days everyone did what seemed right in their own eyes because there was no king was a statement that looked how screwed up the people were because they didn't have a king to lead them. But the book of Ruth is set during the time of the judges. There's no war that's going on through this book. It's a very simple story, and it's not difficult to understand, and so I'm not going to talk a lot about it. But the main thing that you need to understand is at the very end of it, where they give a genealogy and they show how she was like the great-grandmother of David, is the reason why that book is in the Bible. Although it's an inspiring, pious story, But it's all about how Naomi, because the people of Bethlehem are going through a famine, she and her family go to Moab because there was food there. And her husband dies, and then her two sons marry two Moabite women, and they die. And so Naomi's left with her two daughter-in-laws, and she tells them both to go back to their mother, but Ruth chooses to stay with her. And so they travel back to Bethlehem, and when the people see Naomi, they recognize her, but she says, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mari," which means bitter, because I came out full, and I've come back with nothing. And so then they're destitute. So the law of Moses allowed poor people to glean the fields of people. So when you harvested your crops, you could pick your crops one time, but you couldn't go back a second time to pick them, because whatever was left was, if you something dropped and you didn't pick it up, or anything that might have came to fruition later on after you harvested, you had to leave that for the poor. So she was out in the fields gleaning, and she encounters Boaz. And it turns out Boaz is a relative of Naomi. And this brings into play another law of Moses, which is the law of the kinsman redeemer. And that's that if your family had to sell its property because you got into debt, or if you were even sold into slavery, a kinsman had the right to redeem your property on your behalf as long as they were a near relative. And so when Naomi finds out about this, she's, you know, very happy to see that God's blessed her daughter-in-law, and she sees what could possibly develop from this. And she encourages Ruth to go and make herself known to Boaz. He's on the threshing floor. A lot of these are customs that didn't even continue on even into the time of the monarchy. So these are ancient customs that are talked about and in some cases explained in this book, because, like I said, they didn't continue. But she asked Boaz to cover her with his cloak, which was a sign that he was accepting her as a kinsman and offering to redeem her. And so he, in chapter 4, you know, he discovers, this is sort of the little plot twist, he discovers that there's one kinsman who's closer than he is to Naomi and has more of a right to redeem her, goes before the people of the town and basically tells this guy, look, either do it and you can take the redeem the land and take Ruth as your wife, or I'll do it. The guy was happy to redeem the land, but he wasn't happy to take on a wife, and so he opts out and Boaz marries her. So basically, the structure of this book is it begins with a story of death, grief, and loss, and it ends with gain, joy, and life. Because at the very end of the book, Ruth has a child, and that child is like the grandfather of King David. And also, there's typological stuff that the fathers point out about this too. Because in many ways, you could say Naomi represents the people of the Old Testament, who didn't bear a whole lot of fruit. At the end of the story of the Old Testament, there wasn't a lot they had to show for all the time that God had been working with them. And yet Ruth represents the church of the Gentiles, who comes and joins herself to the people of God. And she is fruitful and gives birth to children and ultimately to the line of the king. Any questions about that? Or anything else that we talked about?
Going back to Samson, would it be logical to say in a battle situation, some guy storms a machine gun nest, he knows he's going to get killed, he's feeding the enemy. Could you look at it? In other words, Samson didn't commit suicide, he gave his life in a righteous act.
Well, I think that there's definitely a distinction between doing something that results in your death because it has to be done versus doing something that results in your death because you're despairing. And that's the sin of suicide, is that you're just giving up hope and you're killing yourself because you don't want to face reality. But there's more than a few stories in the lives of the saints of people who did things that they knew were going to result in them being killed. but they did it because they were willing to sacrifice for other people or to stand firm for the Lord. And so, yeah, I would say that that's not suicide in the same sense. Okay. All right. Well, next time we'll talk about probably 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings and maybe also 1 and 2 Chronicles, because they're all very similar. And again, those are not books that are really difficult to understand, but there are some things about them that you, if you understand about them, will help you get a better idea of why they're actually in the Bible.